One of the crucial things you said is you made it into a situation that is more like teaching, more like a classroom setup, basically. And I think the reason why you use that metaphor, that situation, is because teaching for you, I think, like for me and like for Katharina, is about connection. It's about connecting over ideas to other people. And that's exactly what an exam is not. An exam is about eliminating connection and about creating distance.
Welcome to the first episode of the Unconditional Teaching podcast. Unconditional Teaching is a project by Jessica Koch, Tilsi Bura and me, Katharina Peach. Together we write articles and record interviews in which we investigate how we can create healthier relationships in learning and teaching. In this episode, Till and I talk to Jessica about her experience of writing and defending her PhD thesis and the severe strain both put on her mental health. In the second part of this interview, we talk about the genderedness of discourses of resilience and suffering and why it is so difficult to acknowledge traumatic experiences when you are pursuing an academic career. Finally, Jessica tells us more about how she exercised agency to create her actual PhD defense as a situation of security and support for herself by inviting students, colleagues and friends. Do you know anything about how other PhD students deal with the pressures of pursuing a PhD project? So, have you talked to people who have had experiences similar to yours, or are there people who deal with this very differently?
I have spoken both to people who went through the process, so who went, who did it and completed the PhD phase, and I also talked to people who stopped doing it and basically went out of academia to work in different positions out there in the world, essentially. And what I have observed, I don't know if this is a general truth, but what I have observed is that there's a tendency for female PhD students or female researchers to have a similar approach to the final PhD product and to the whole research that was involved as I do, like saying, okay, I either don't want to publish this with a publishing house, I don't want to look at this ever again, or I did publish this and I find it painful to look at. I find it painful to have this thing in my immediate vicinity. I cannot look at this. So they perceive the trauma as trauma and they talk about the trauma as trauma, or they refuse to acknowledge, this is what most often happens. I think there's a lot of people who refuse to acknowledge this as trauma, except for when it happens behind closed doors, when it is like a one-on-one conversation and then it's all done in hushed whispers, more or less, which I can totally understand. It's such a frightening process and there's so much politics involved and then it becomes very, very problematic to talk about how terrible the process was after you've completed it, particularly when jobs are on the line. With men, I oftentimes find that they speak about their own PhD thesis with an intense sense of pride and what looks like from the outside, like enjoyment. Like they will hold their books and be like, yeah, but don't you want to have something like this and display it? They talk about it like a trophy, like they went out hunting, killing a beast, essentially, and that now they have this trophy that they can show. And basically this is the reward that they show. And then they will also have the same scars. I'm not saying they're not as traumatized as the women are, but they tell themselves and the world, essentially, look, this is what I did this for. My battle scars aren't in vain. I do think, however, that this narrative of the trophy or this was worth it is not really a sign of pride. I do not believe that most of these people feel pride. Most of these men feel pride. I do think what they feel is relief. Relief that this is over.
Just another comment on the genderedness of this discourse of resilience and suffering. I think in our society and in academia too, men are more encouraged to draw strength from experiences of suffering. So discourse of resilience and overcoming the suffering. Well, for women, the suffering is often framed as a form of victimization, as a form of victimhood that attaches to you. So it's doubly hard for women to deal with experiences of this kind of suffering without falling back into shame and guilt and carrying it with them as a traumatic experience. While men sort of are supposed to have this shell of, I went through this, I came out okay, even though they're not, but they have the proof of it, they have the book, and they rather show it than admit how it maybe damaged them.
Yeah, it's simply, I mean, in the whole of academia, it's not very encouraged to talk about the damage academia can do to our mental health. But I think for men in particular, because of the prevailing discourses of masculinity, it's even harder to come to the conclusion that such processes are painful, and then to deal with the pain appropriately by, for instance, getting therapy or at least, you know, getting some sort of counseling to make sense of the pain that one has gone through. I do think that a lot of people in academia right now are damaged because of the whole process. I'm certainly damaged, and I do think a lot of people that I know and love are also ready to acknowledge that they have been damaged by this process. And for some people, they feel like there's no return, there's no healing in this.
I am writing a PhD thesis right now, but I have never heard anyone address this before, actually. So not when I try to make an informed decision about whether I wanted to do it, and also not from colleagues who have finished their PhD or are in the process of writing their thesis right now. So at least in my experience, people actually don't talk about this, at least not openly.
It's not like people don't speak about this. It's just that, you know, there are loads of articles when I realized, okay, this is depression and this has something to do with me doing a PhD thesis and this is dangerous. I started Googling the thing. So PhD, other PhD student experiences and so on and so forth, and what psychologists say and what people who are like way further into their academic careers. And there are these reports about people saying, look, this was a traumatizing experience, or this was painful, or this did something to my mental health, so on and so forth. And even in our university, at our university or at conferences, I would talk to people who were very, very willing to share their experience with me as soon as they realized, oh, okay, so there's a kindred spirit I can talk to. Mm. But I think what is missing, particularly in the German context, is the willingness and the openness to engage in such conversations in true honesty in larger contexts. I've had colleagues of mine be at my office, talk to me about their own experiences. I've been at conferences where people over coffee in one corner at the conference venue would then talk to me about their own PhD experiences, and even experiences that go beyond that, so other types of testing that they had to go through. But this was all done almost in hushed whispers or with closed office doors, because this is still perceived to be something that is shameful or so private that people feel that they shouldn't or couldn't talk about this in public. And I don't think this is private. These feelings of inadequacy, I wasn't born with that, and I wasn't born depressed. But the demands that were being put on me made it so that I became ill. And my illness is not just my own concern, but it should also be the concern of the system that makes it so that not just I, but many, many people who do the same thing that I do fall ill with serious mental and physical health issues. So I do think we have a long way to go when it comes to being open about what these testing and exam mechanisms do, and whether or not it's a humane thing to keep them as they are, or whether or not we shouldn't say goodbye to this whole comparability idea that doesn't work in the first place, and to this nimbus of testing to make sure we only let the good people into a very elite circle of academics. But whether or not we wouldn't rather go for something that is more inclusive, that is actually focused on ideas, on the output of good ideas and the negotiation of new intellectual ventures, really, instead of focusing so much on grades and testing and pushing people through exams that have requirements that are oftentimes very arbitrary and very confusing.
Why do you think it is so hard for people to openly talk about what these testing mechanisms, specifically the whole PhD process, have done to them?
I do think that if we were to acknowledge the fact that this was painful and that this hurt us and that this has changed us, that this has made us less healthy, that this has traumatized us, it would call into question our very decision to pursue this career in the first place. Mm-hmm. And this is, of course, a very dangerous path for people who are associating their identity with their scholarship. This is a very dangerous path for me to go down, because if I'm starting to question my very decision to write this PhD thesis, if this indeed made me so sick, if this made me depressed to the point of me thinking about killing myself, is this really the right decision to continue in this path? Was the last... Is the work that I did the last 10 years essentially worthless because I will have to quit university and start something new in order to stay alive, in order to support myself, in order to stay at least somewhat healthy and sane? That's big. These are huge questions. And I think if you start going down that path, there is no coming back from it. This means to have to face the fact that you participated in your own torture, and in your own, to the detriment of your own health, essentially. And that's a tough pill to swallow.
What were the reasons for you to actually continue?
Before I realized part of how this worked, it was because I thought, I can't do anything else. This is the only thing I'm good at, and this is the only thing I will be paid for. And if I can get 3 years or 4 years of paid scholarship, it will be worth it. I'm just a small student, and they're giving me this huge opportunity, and I can't possibly say no. Also because I bought into this whole narrative of the wasted potential. If I don't do this now, then I will never get the chance to do that again. And people will forever look at me with disappointment and with sadness, because I didn't get to unfold my full potential because I made the foolish decision of not pursuing this. About three to a half years in into my PhD thesis, so when I was almost done, it started to dawn on me when I realized, okay, I'm suffering from depression. This is making me sick. And once I talked to my therapist about this, and once I talked to my colleagues, you guys, about what is happening to me, and it dawned on me that this is a systemic thing too, that this is not just me being weak, mm-hmm. and not resilient, mm-hmm. enough. I think the reason for why I stayed and why I still finished it, although I felt like I couldn't, was because I still felt like I'm so programmed still to think that this is important for me to finish. And I couldn't have gone on with my life without feeling guilty and without feeling ashamed, because this is how my programming works. And it will take decades for me to deprogram myself. I don't know if I can ever reach that point where I feel comfortable enough with what I'm doing and can feel proud of my accomplishments, because I define my accomplishments. But I know that at the moment I'm not capable of doing that, and I needed to finish it for me to get this feeling of, at least I didn't produce myself a sense of shame and guilt because I didn't finish it. I was at least aware of that, that was the reason for why I needed to continue this. And a bit of it was spite too, because I didn't want to give the system I didn't want to throw in the towel.
Yeah.
It was a bit of spite. The spite was good. The spite helped me to generate a bit of energy that pushed me over the finish line. But that was like very late in the process. Most of the time it was really dragging myself towards the finish line. That was very painful. I realized this after the defense, when I laid in bed that evening after I had laughed and cried and laughed and cried and laughed and cried. I was insane that day. I don't know what went on with me. Very confusing. And I was lying in bed with my husband, and I realized in how much physical pain I was. And still to this day, I mean, I had my defense in November. It's now late January. I still have nightmares about the defense and about writing the PhD thesis. I still wake up thinking I have to work on my PhD thesis, and it takes me a few seconds to realize that I don't. I still have like the almost flashback, like when I encounter certain books or certain texts, or when I see emails from my supervisors that have nothing to do with my PhD thesis, I still get these intense feelings of dread. Not because I dread what these people have to say, or because they were evil or something like that, but because the process of writing this PhD thesis was so terrible that everything that I associate with a PhD thesis immediately triggers this feeling of dread and anxiety, and immediately drains me to the point where I feel that the symptoms from my depression are coming back, so that I feel without energy, that I can't do anything except for lying on the couch, not doing anything really.
I mean, just last week we saw how it affected you being in the room where your thesis defense happened.
Yes.
That wasn't a good place to be for you, obviously.
Yeah, we were sitting in this room and just listening to some talks, and I didn't understand it. A student sitting next to me said, "You don't look too hot." And then I started crying. And it happened again, like the day afterwards, when we were back in this room, and you asked me, you know, what's going on? And I said, you know, this room doesn't do me good. So I realized relatively late that the space in which the thesis defense took place, it triggered me. Although the defense as such wasn't as bad of an experience as everything that led up to it and everything that came after it. It's as I said, I don't really think I will ever fully understand the whole process of, pardon my French, the fuck-uppery that happens there in these processes. But that much I do get.
I would like to ask you more a bit about the actual thesis defense, if you don't mind. I mean, as much as you framed this as a traumatizing process and a re-traumatization after the fact, after you handed in the PhD thesis, with the thesis defense, then I think for all of us who have witnessed you go through that process, who've been at the defense, and all of us who have been at the rehearsal you did, this was an extremely impressive exercise in agency and using the agency you have in coping with that situation, making it for you the best it can be to go through that. Am I correct when I interpret it like this? To me, it certainly looked like this.
Yeah.
And I mean, during the actual defense, you had invited a lot of colleagues, a lot of students of yours, and I took 2 pages of notes, not on what you talked about, but how you carried yourself, the rhetoric you used, the strategies that were on display, that were obviously coping strategies, and which blew my mind that you were so aggressive in putting forth things that you need to do in order to get through this hole in one piece. Can you talk a bit about what you did, why you did that, what it did to you, what it meant to you?
Certainly. I think 2 things come into play. One thing was in my therapy, realizing again, or relearning rather, that I have agency. I think depression made me forget that I had that. This is one of the key evil superpowers of depression. It makes us forget that we have agency in things and that we can gain control over certain things that otherwise make us feel miserable. So this was one thing that I learned in the therapy sessions that I had right before the defense, like regaining this ability to exercise agency in theory. The second bit, and this was equally as important, was realizing that I don't have to do this alone. The mere fact that this... So usually we look at the defense, and at our university, usually by default, this is open to everybody at the university. At first, I thought, this is terrifying. This is absolutely terrifying. I don't want this to be open to everybody. I just want to sit there with my through examiners and be done with it. Just so that in case I fail, the shame would not be as big. And then I realized that what I actually needed is something to be different from this being alone with my examiners. Because the thing that terrifies me personally, was not the idea of being in front of a group of people speaking, because I do this as a job all the time. I can talk in front of 20, 30, 80, 100 people. That's okay. That's stressful, but that's not freaking me out. What was freaking me out, what was making me ill, was the very fact that this was an exam. So I thought, how can I turn this into something that is less like an exam and more like me teaching?
Yeah.
So what I did was I basically invited everyone who I felt could give me a sense of security. So that included you guys, that included a lot of my colleagues, a lot of our Hilfskräfte, the students who are working with us, and also students I enjoy talking to. Students who I felt could benefit from seeing a defense firsthand, because this could help them make an informed decision about whether or not they would like to go through this process themselves, whether this would be worth it. So I invited everybody and said, look, no matter what, there will be cake afterwards. So this is a win-win situation. And I saw this as a sort of, okay, I'm turning this into something that is more to my taste, something that is more to my liking. And the defense day was super weird in the beginning because, you know, technology didn't work out and I was alone for 2 hours there and waiting for everybody to sort of pour in. But the moment that you guys came and the students poured in, there was this, I just felt so safe. I realized I had created my own little safe space in an exam that would determine whether or not I would be allowed to have the title that I worked for the past 4 years. And I realized that I was just here and the next 90 minutes would be me speaking to people I like and people who like to talk to me about my ideas and who, if they have feedback for me or responses to my ideas, that they would let me know, but that everything would be fine. And seeing my examiners also reacting to this, I think, I'm not entirely sure, I didn't speak with them afterwards about the whole center, but I do think that maybe there was this element of surprise. There were so many people in the room who were just there to listen to me, my ideas in this exam. And for me, this made all the difference. It gave me a lot of security. It gave me a lot of, it gave them me the feeling of being loved and cared for. And in a situation where everything is so frightening and so devastatingly complicated and dreadful and existential in scope, just feeling support by having people there that I liked and who liked me back made all the difference.
What impressed me so much about your choice to do it this way was that, and you talked about agency and how difficult this can be. And because for me, it was really an exertion of an exercise in agency, because what you basically said was, well, I don't have to subject myself to all the rules and to all the constraints of this exam situation. I can try to figure out where are the things, like the gaps in the rules that allow me to create the situation in my favor. And doing this, I think one of the most important things in general that we can do when we try to create experiences of self-efficacy and agency in institutions, to not let ourselves be determined by the context and the situations and the circumstances completely, but looking, watching out for what are the things where I can do something about it. And I think that the outcome, that the effect this had worked so well is amazing. But I think even trying to do this, even trying to exercising agency or to creating agency for yourself is already a very important step within systems.
One of the crucial things you said, I think, is you made it into a situation that is more like teaching, more like a classroom setup, basically. And I think the reason why you use that metaphor, that situation, is because teaching for you, I think, like for me and like for Katharina, is about connection. It's about connecting over ideas to other people. And that's exactly what an exam is not. An exam is about eliminating connection and about creating distance.
Absolutely.
And you sort of redefined the entire situation and made yourself open to connection just by having an opposite, but just by creating an opposite that listens,
yeah,
that engages with your idea,
yeah,
who know you as a person. And that was a really powerful move in the moment, and everyone could see that and
yeah,
feel that. And
yeah, I certainly found that.
Yeah.
I think I have to give credit where credit is due. One of my students, Leah, we talked about the defense before, like a few weeks before the defense actually took place. And she asked me how I feel about this, and I told her I'm not entirely sure. I used the word re-traumatization back then too, and I told her this defense exam doesn't have any meaning in and of itself to me. It feels like I'm being made to do this without any rhyme or reason. I don't really see the point, and nobody's able to explain the point to me. I had very, very friendly, benevolent examiners for whom this defense was, I think, nothing but one of the appointments that they had that day, which is absolutely fair. But it just goes to show the discrepancy between what this is for examiners and what this is for people who are being examined, who are the examinees, as it were. And I told my student, look, this doesn't have meaning for me. I have trouble to deal with preparing for the defense, and I feel my depression coming back in part because I don't see the point of this exam. And she looked at me and she gave it a thought and she said one of the wisest things I've ever heard anybody say. She looked at me and she said, well, you know what? I don't know if this is helpful, but you invited me to come and listen to you speak. And to me, this is meaningful. And I almost cried. It was like, I was like so touched by this. And what she did was make this defense meaningful for me. It became meaningful because she could derive meaning from that as my student, as somebody who felt invited to come to something that students are usually not explicitly invited to, although, of course, to open defenses, they're always allowed to come, but they don't know that. And simply having given her this explicit invite to say, look, come and witness my imminent demise. This is how I phrased it, I think. It was important to her and it was meaningful to her. It was, as you put it, like as in teaching, it was a moment of connection. She felt seen and I could make myself be seen through establishing this connection. And when I realized that this was meaningful for her, it made the whole thing more meaningful to me. And I think this just grew, the sense of meaningfulness grew the more people said, yes, we're going to be there. We're going to support you and we're going to listen to what you have to say. And then looking at all of your faces, one of our colleagues sat there with the brightest of smiles, completely looking at me. And I thought, why did I put that look on her face? But she was so like listening to me and paying attention, and I couldn't help but feel like this is cool. I enjoyed it. Like 10 minutes in, I started to enjoy the whole thing. Not because it was an exam, but because there were like 20, 25 people in the room who were actually listening to me and had fun because I was there. And that was cool.
Yeah, it was cool for us too.
Thank you.
Can I also ask... Now, we do this interview to put this out there, to communicate this. You're being incredibly honest and open about your experience, about this being a traumatic experience. I think we started the Unconditional Teaching website as an outlet to discuss the things that we see going wrong at university, as an outlet for our ideas to make it better, to find solutions. And we decided to open with this because this was your recent experience, and to shed a light on things that people habitually don't speak about, which is where there's a lot of taboo around it. Does that feel good to you to speak about that? Is that okay? Does it give it meaning? I don't know.
Yes. It's a coping mechanism. It doesn't, it gives post hoc sense to events that don't make sense in and of themselves. And I think that is one way of how we can deal with trauma, or how psychotherapy, as far as I understand it, as a patient essentially, works. It's taking an event or a condition, a series of events that don't make sense in and of themselves, that cannot be on their own merit, be integrated into our own life story, into our own experiences in a meaningful way, and giving them meaning. For me, the Unconditional Teaching project and talking about my experiences are one way in which I can give this meaning after the fact, essentially. Talking about this to my students is another way of doing this. I cannot prevent, and I do not want to prevent, my students from, you know, becoming a doctor of literature and to pursue a career in academia. But I can make them more aware of the downsides of academia, and I can invite them by talking about these experiences to become more aware of their own vulnerability, in a sense, and that because we are all vulnerable to systemic pressures, we need to take extra care of ourselves. And sometimes taking extra care of ourselves means to say no. It means to reject expectations. It means to reject political demands that are being pushed onto our passion projects. Sometimes it means saying yes to these demands. But it always requires us to be like super reflective when it comes to these projects and be very, very mindful in how to deal with ourselves in these times of intense pressure. And I think that's what I can add. In the long term, I don't see any other option but to change the system and change the system radically, because as it is right now, it's terrible. It's a terrible thing to put people through. It's terrible for PhD students. It's terrible for students who do not want to have a PhD. It's terrible for professors. It's terrible for everyone involved. And everyone can acknowledge this, but everybody sort of also seems to say, well, there's no way we can change this. We can. We have the power to change this. So let's make this happen.
Let's make this happen.
Let's make this happen.
Thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for listening. Unconditional Teaching is a project by Tilsi Bura, Jessica Koch, and me, Katharina Pietsch. Music by Lily Olason. If you want to know more about our project and our partners, check out unconditional-teaching.com. Do you like our content or would like to engage with us? Head over to our comment sections or contact us via team@unconditional-teaching.com.